This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today on Sticks In, we briefly recap the PLL regular season now that the game's in Salt Lake City and the full thing is wrapped up. We talk through each team's sort of outlook the rest of the way and first round matchups that are taking place this weekend on the field at Gillette Stadium. Plus, we look a little bit at the announcement of street lacrosse that came from the PLL and boardroom this week. And then just a quick update from me about Sticks In and the whole shebang and how it's all going. Let's do it. Welcome to a later than typically in the week episode of Sticks In. Thank you for coming back again. I wish these were more regular. I do apologize that they're not. I'm doing my best, but real life is kind of intervening for me these last couple weeks, but I'm trying to get at least them out on a weekly basis. So we are still going to recap a whole bunch of the games from last week. I am still maybe just catching up on sleep, but you know, it really didn't hit me until like late night on Saturday, Sunday, whatever it was, that those last press conferences wrapped up after the Salt Lake City games, that the PLL regular season is over. Those lax after darks are done, which is nice. No more going to bed at 1, 2 in the morning. But the season went by in a blink of an eye. It really didn't take very long, did it? I think it's kind of because there really hasn't been an empty lacrosse weekend since, you know, since like Memorial Day. It's all flown right by. We went straight from the Final Four into PLL season and, you know, start right then in Albany with training camp and everything. The only break the PLL has really had has been for World Championships. So that was obviously just, you know, lacrosse basically every day there for Worlds. And then it was just right back to the PLL, who didn't have any empty weeks. The only empty weekend for the PLL season, other than the Worlds break, is this weekend between the semis and the championship. So that's really the only empty lacrosse weekend since like May. I cannot be clear enough about this that I am not at all complaining here. I love it. And not to get into like a big discussion about it, but I'd love it if this was the way the PLL was going forward without the break for Worlds, you know, like no buys. I think if you do that, maybe you start thinking if it's possible to start Memorial Day weekend and end Labor Day, because that's something I've always loved, the idea of doing that, right? You kind of plant a flag on the holidays that bookend the summer. Everyone always complains there's no summer sports, you get into the dog days, there's no sports on, there's nothing. Lacrosse can literally run the summer that way. They can kick off and play the college title game and then roll that right into the start of the summer pro league, and then stake a claim for the entire summer. From Memorial Day to Labor Day, lacrosse owns it. I think that would be really cool. But no empty weekends, of course, is brutal for players. Even as the league goes geo-based, it's still hard. Anyway, PLL regular season is in the books. So before we look at that, though, before we get too far down the PLL season route, let's look real quick at the announcement that came from Boardroom. I believe it came from Boardroom first. That's where I saw it first. If it was somewhere else first, I apologize. But Boardroom and the PLL announced street lacrosse. Press release says, quote, street lacrosse is meant to parallel pickup lacrosse. Players only need sticks and a ball, commonly a tennis ball, to go with any agreed upon boundaries, goal target, and score. The first ever street lacrosse open run will feature pro and amateur games between PLL athletes and PLL assist partners like Bronx Lacrosse, Harlem Lacrosse, City Lacs, and Brooklyn Lacrosse. And then we had a quote from Paul Rabel Quote, when KD and Ace invest in the PLL, we all knew our biggest impact would come from creating more access to the sport by giving back to the community. Much like the game of basketball, street lacrosse will function as an equalizer for anyone who wants to pick up and play. We couldn't be more excited about the launch of this movement. And then from Ace Kleiman, quote, if in everything we do, we want to work with great people, put on great events, and give back to the community. We strongly believe in Paul and PLL's vision for their league. The chance to be able to partner with them not only helps grow the sport, but gives Boardroom the opportunity to create an event in New York that reflects our love for the city and its culture as well. This will be the first of many collabs between PLL and Boardroom, end quote. That open run that they talked about in the release there, that is September 8th, which is a Friday next week. That's at Kevin Durant's Eastside Courts in New York. It takes place at 5:30 p.m. STX and PLL, I know, are donating. They're giving away sticks and nets and like 1,000 mini sticks for people to show up and play. If I didn't have a in my personal life unmissable event that evening, I would be there, but I have to be in Connecticut. So I kind of took a little time to think about street lacrosse and the announcement and kind of, you know, you didn't want to just like knee jerk to it. It's a big thing. You know, you've got obviously Boardroom, you've got KD attached to it as an investor in the league. It's not nothing. So when I first saw it, I kind of had a hard time placing exactly what this street lacrosse thing is really meant to be. So part of my brain is like immediately just goes to, oh, great, another lacrosse discipline. You know, we got field, we got box, we got international, we got sixes. Now we have this street lacrosse thing. Are we muddying the waters further about what lacrosse is? Is this just getting too hard for people? And I struggled with the line in the press release of, you know, all right, it's meant to parallel pickup lacrosse. Well, from what I can tell, it just is pickup lacrosse, right? Like it's having a stick and a ball and figuring it out. Isn't that what pickup lacrosse is? I don't know. Do we need street? Like, what's that part of it? I just kept looking for places where this thing occupies in the lacrosse world. You know, you try and find a place where it fits, the little space in the lacrosse landscape that says this is where the opening was and here's where street lacrosse fills that opening. But really, I think I was missing the point, you know, with taking time to further, like, think about it and just gather my thoughts and, like, take it all in. I really definitely was missing the point with that thinking. I think the core of the whole thing, right, is still about just accessibility. Like, the name and the way it's all done and all that is secondary to what we're really, the mission really is here. If you remember, Eamon McEnany was on the pod a while back. We talked about CityLax and what they are doing to grow lacrosse in inner cities and in communities that don't traditionally, you know, have lacrosse as an option. They're growing programs through those clinics, financial support. They bring pros out at like the middle school level, you know, getting the kids out there. And I hear that, and I said it on the pod to Eamon, that's what I think of when you get the old hashtag grow the game. That's what it looks like to me. It's not about some baby step being taken at a college level or something like that. It's kids. More kids playing lacrosse, more kids playing who didn't play. And the only thing really keeping them from playing was an opportunity to play. Let the kids play, let them fall in love with the game. Just like everybody else who's a pro now, I'm sure at some point had their moment as a kid where they fell in love with the game. People aren't having their opportunity to do that. And this is what street lacrosse is trying to do, right? As I look at street lacrosse, that's what the idea is, but strip the game down further, just stick and ball. All that other stuff, leave it aside. Oh, you need a field to play? Nope. You need a rink if you're playing box? Nope. You need goals? Nope. Need equipment? A stick. All the really serious, expensive barriers that can exist to lacrosse, particularly in an urban environment, to playing the game, get put aside for just the sake of an introduction to the game. Get the kids to play and let them love it. That's it. In that regard, I think street lacrosse absolutely is, you know, it has its heart in the right place. You know, we talk about lacrosse on ESPN, grow the game, all over social media, grow the game. I truly don't think it moves the needle for some kids that it needs to move the needle with just in those channels. There are kids who will show up to the first street lacrosse open run that have never played before. And when lacrosse comes up on SportsCenter, they zone out. It's not a game that they maybe have interest in playing, maybe because of stereotypes, maybe because of something else, whatever. You know, maybe there's peer pressure to not play it, depending on where they're from. You got to play other sports, play football, play baseball, whatever. You probably have a couple of members of the old Not a Sport comment brigade out there. And for some of those folks, the Not a Sport folks, like the clip on social, the SportsCenter top 10 play, it's not changing their minds. If it could, it would have by now. There's no magical highlight clip that's coming that all the people who hated lacrosse before or thought it wasn't a sport before will see and be like, okay, I retract my last 40 comments about how it's not a sport because this BTB has changed my outlook on life and athletics. That's not happening. I don't think the breakthrough ever happens that way. The breakthrough happens when people play the game, when they get the chance to participate in it, not just be shown it, to have a stick in their hands and try it. If street lacrosse takes barriers to play, again, I think playing is the critical part of this whole thing. If street lacrosse takes the barriers to play and reduces them to nothing, to as little as it possibly can be, then it's a sincere effort and move towards real, legitimate growth. That's the idea. It's not some other discipline, right? I was going down the wrong path. My brain was not working correctly when I tried to think about it that way. Because the whole idea of it ever being like an organized, competitive thing with like referees and hard, fast rules, like that's counter to the core of the whole idea, right? That's not street lacrosse anymore. Then you're just playing some other kind of lacrosse. Street lacrosse by its sort of foundation is just showing up to a place and making it up as you go. So I'm a fan. I can't make that first open run. Whenever they have their next one, I promise I will be there. But I hope they make them a regular thing, you know, in New York or in other places, other cities. Because like I said, man, it's about getting sticks in hands. And if that's what the goal is here, just get kids out there to throw the ball around. They don't got to worry about attack or defense or where you can run or what you can do or any like the rules, anything. They just get to learn how fun it is to have a couple people with sticks and the balls running around and try to play some lacrosse. So I think it's a positive thing. That's kind of the street lacrosse take. Something else I mentioned at the top, I wanted to kind of take a second to clear something up since I just finished speaking pretty strongly in support of a new PLL thing. I honestly, maybe this isn't worth the time and this is a mistake, but for some reason, like my comment section in the old DM folder has been higher than usual with some of the heat lately. So I just wanted to clear the air on something. The PLL does not pay me. I don't work for them. I don't do media on their behalf. They don't ask me to write or say anything. I don't pitch them on things I want to say or things I want to write. I set up Sticks In with the number one goal of being independent from the leagues themselves, basically. I don't have any kind of sponsorship with them. I have no deals. I have no nothing. It's the only way I really feel good about trying to be truly objective with the stuff that I do. I don't feel like I could be otherwise. It's pretty easy to tell this is the case if you really think about it. It's not like the PLL is pumping any of my stuff on social or amplifying any work that I do, and that's a good thing. I want it that way. It demonstrates healthy divide between league and media trying to cover it. I think that's a good thing to have. So I consider like a healthy respect there, obviously. They don't hate me. I don't hate them. There's no like, you know, there's nothing like that going on. When I say I like a thing that the PLL is doing, it's because I like that thing. And I think it's something that's like cool and noteworthy about the game. It's not because they asked me to. Same, obviously, if I say something I don't like, they don't ask me to do that either. But, you know. Like I take a look at Ticketmaster every week and I post what ticket availability looks like because I think that's interesting. I think it's interesting to see what ticket sales look like throughout the week for PLL events. And then, of course, every time I do that, it's like, oh, well, you know, there's a couple sections with a couple rows left and this and that. That's kind of usually how I do it. And then on game day, of course, I get like the, you know, you get the old burner army, the troll army, screen grabs their view of the seats on TV at halftime and says, oh, there's nobody there. It's not a sellout. You're just pushing a PLL narrative. Rabels are telling you to say that they sold out the tickets. To which I say, look, if the grand conspiracy is the Ticketmaster is actually not selling tickets, but making it look like tickets are sold and you can't actually buy them, but nobody can. And the map is all a grand conspiracy between the PLL and Ticketmaster to say that they sold tickets they didn't actually sell. And then they reached out to me of all people to push that story. If that's kind of where you get off on things, like that's the, something you think is real, then yeah. Twitter probably is a good place for you. Like the Twitter reply sounds like the kind of place you're supposed to be. So, look, every week I look at ticket availability. I post viewership for linear TV games. I'm sure the PLL loves when I do that. And the numbers are great. I'm sure they don't love it when I do it. And the numbers aren't great because there's weeks where both are true. But I do it either way. because there's nobody out there telling me I should say this, I shouldn't say that, or trying to influence the way I say things or what I have to say about things. So I hope the day comes along where at some point this all becomes something where somebody pays me to write or pays me to say some of the things that I say. If that happens, I'll be thrilled, but that certainly isn't right now. So I do this because I love to do it. I think it's coverage that real pro sports and real pro athletes, which is what we're dealing with here, deserve. That's it. Maybe if I want to get paid, I should get an agent. Maybe that's my problem. Karenlian, DM me. Sign me. Anyway, that's that. For the trolls, who I'm sure will continue to troll, enjoy that. Whatever. That's that. Onwards to the Salt Lake City weekend. Back to the PLL stuff. Let's get right back to it after that. Talking to people who were there, who were, you know, in Salt Lake for the weekend, it seems like it was a really big success. I know the word afterward was Paul Vabil telling the crowd, "We're going to see you soon." I know there were some big time people who were major parts of the Utah lacrosse community, like David Nieleman was there, I think, sitting by the side of the field. If you don't know who David Nieleman is, Google JetBlue. But obviously that's a man with a serious passion for lacrosse. He's got kids who play, who played at Utah. He's, you know, got a connection to the area and he's got plenty of money. So the day ever comes, you want a franchisee out in the Utah area, he's probably not a bad guy to start talking to now. But, you know, of course, all that kind of adds up to people wondering, all right, it looks like maybe Utah's going to get one of these teams. I still don't know, you know, who's getting the teams, who's not. It's really tough to get a feel for it at this point. I will say, you know, in postgame, I wanted to, it's something I really wanted to know about. So I asked Coach Holman, you know, he's a Maryland guy. He grew up in Maryland, you know, he went to the bluest of blue bloods for schools, coached the bluest of blue bloods, you know, as did obviously his son, Marcus. And then he went out to Utah to build a lacrosse program. So I wanted to ask him from his time there, what about the lacrosse program there reminds him of home? And he said, honestly, not a damn thing, which I thought was funny. But, you know, he talked for a little while about how special it was to be out there and what's kind of happened there. Because, I mean, really, you look at it again. He's a Maryland guy to Hopkins, to Carolina, you know, then out to Utah, where they just kind of were interested and they wanted to have this thing, this lacrosse thing happen. So he went out there to do it. Who does he go to do it with? He goes with Will Manny, a Long Island St. Anthony's UMass guy, his son Marcus, a Gilman School UNC guy, and Adam Gettleman, a Cold Spring Harvard UVA guy. None of that adds up in any way to let's all go to Utah. You know, like as you look at that on paper, you're just like, what? These guys all went to Utah to build a lacrosse program? But what they did was special, because they really bought in as a group and that community really bought into what their vision and what they were trying to do was out there in Utah. And now it is this thing that, you know, they're forever attached to that program, to that area. And the Utes are a top 20 program and they pull talent from all over America. So I thought it was a really cool way, I thought, to end the regular season with a story like that of real serious growth in lacrosse. To the games themselves, Archers, Water Dogs pull off that frantic, I mean, basically miraculous comeback, and they win at 14-13. You know, I started thinking about how that changes the tone heading to the playoffs, right? If the Archers win that game, they fight off that comeback, it's like they're juggernaut time. They're the top seed. They beat the top three team to close the regular season. You know, they've got an MVP at worst, you know, primary candidate, a top two MVP candidate, really, and Tom Schreiber at worst, if not the front runner. You know, they're looking invulnerable, basically. Instead, the Water Dogs score three goals in the final 28 seconds of game clock, taking a lead on a Kieran McArdle putback with about 3 seconds left. And now all of a sudden, we're back to the it's anybody's title thing. Are the Archers still a favorite? Sure. Definitely. But the talk's maybe going to be a little bit different, right? Is that curse of the one seed where they never get out of the, you know, they never win the whole thing? Does that get a little bit louder for the Archers now? There's the talk of the Archers in past years who have been great on paper, had good regular seasons, but just kind of petered out in the playoffs. Does that talk get a little louder because of the way their regular season ended? I'm not saying the Archers shouldn't be the favorite. They should. They are at worst, at the very worst, above average at every position on the field, and they are a top two or top three team in the league at most positions on the field, at really every position on the field. attacking a team that has that few weaknesses, like the Archers, I think is the challenge of the postseason. We don't get to see them play at Gillette because, like I said, they're the one seed. They have the bye. The first team we'll see them play will be the winner of the Redwoods Chaos game, and that'll be on Long Island. But, you know, the talk around the Archers, not necessarily this week, but as you look into next week, into getting towards their game, particularly depending on how the outcome of that Redwoods Chaos game goes, could be interesting. The Water Dogs got back to doing basically how they were doing it, you know, back in Ohio and on their kind of their win run that started there. They had this way of just picking themselves off the mat in a game where they just took haymakers and then managed to pull a win out with some late knockout punch, you know, some 12th round huge blow to get a win. You know, you look at that game in Ohio where they basically started deploying the prevent the first time we saw it and had this massive comeback with all these two-pointers, these huge shots against Atlas, and they pulled a win out in a 19-18 game. They just started finding ways to win. And they've been doing that for most of the year. They've just been manufacturing ways to win. Their personnel is going to have them in every game. Dylan Ward should be up for goalie of the year, even maybe an MVP kind of guy, but you know, he's only appeared in five games, whatever, it's five or six, something like that. So obviously, you know, he's not going to get a lot of award nods when you're not available for most of the year. You know, he had the NLL thing to start, then he had paternity leave. So, but his save percentage is over 60. Only goalie in the league doing that right now, I think. And with the defense in front of him, the Dogs are a tough team to break. I think Matt Witcher has been one of the best short stick D-middies in the league this year. He's not up for the award, but I feel like his game has really elevated this year. You know, I said on social that I thought last year he sometimes had moments where he was playing like he looked a little bit scared or like he didn't want to lose his job. And this year he looks like, you know, like one of the best in the league. And I know some of the Water Dogs guys disagreed. They thought he's always been that good. I think he's always been good. But, I guess the point I was trying to make with was that the confidence that he's playing with right now to take it to the goal and transition to, you know, and you can see how much the defense trusts, you know, him behind him and that they don't slide to him as much. There's a confidence and just like an air about his game that just wasn't there last year where he looks so much more confident. I don't know how else to describe it. He's definitely an underrated part of that defensive unit. The question for the Water Dogs, I think might be, does something happen? Are they playing with fire too much? They seed possession on the faceoff. They have every single one since Ohio. The Archers nearly made them lose for it. If the clock is ticking down late, will they be able to mount comebacks in games where they are giving possessions away? If a team throws a wrinkle at them that they've been saving for the year, waiting for this kind of moment, or they just manage to play super high efficient offense in a 32-second clock for one game, because that's all they need to do. Do it for one game. And they play make it take it for a quarter and a half. Can the Water Dogs battle back from that kind of thing? They opened the playoffs with the Whipsnakes. Water Dogs won that regular season meeting. That was before the All-Star game. And again, I said this on social today, but in that game, they had no Michael Earhart. They had no Brad Smith. They had no Matt Dunn. Kyle Burnler got hurt in the first half and Matt Rambo got hurt late. And the Whips were winning that game in the fourth quarter with 8 minutes left by two goals. They'll be at full strength for this one. It's going to be a good one. That's a good one. I'm excited for that game. Next game of the weekend was Redwoods 12 and Atlas 7. Redwoods end the regular season on a three-game win streak. Cole Kirst, 5 more points. He's now 4th on the team, by far leading their midfield. And he's played in just 7 games. He doesn't have those, you know, with 3 more games, who knows where he'd be. But he may up being, in terms of like value from where you drafted the guy, he might be the pick of the draft. For a guy that you got that late doing what he's doing. Assuming you don't count, like, you know, Etherwall being undrafted. A guy who was actually drafted. But the scary thing in this game for the Woods is they dealt with this kind of game-shattering event. And I thought it maybe threw them off a little bit. They're up 5-0 in the first. After the first. 5-0 lead after one. They shut out the Atlas in the first quarter. Ultimately, they end up going out to an 8-0 lead. But, you know, you have this kind of scary hit that sends Nekhai Montgomery out of the game. He definitely looked, you know, you could tell he was hurt. He did not look like a like somebody who was getting ready to come back into the game anytime soon as he left the field. He was clearly feeling it. And it just looked to me like the Woods were maybe a little shook by it. I don't know. The Atlas battle back. They outscore the Woods over the game's last 2.5 quarters. Redwoods, you know, I feel like they tend to ride the waves of the emotions in games to extremes. When they're going good, they are really going good. When they're going bad, it's bad. Managing those extremes, especially in a playoff game, I think is, you know, obviously key to their success. To me, I think a lot of that, you know, lands on guys, you know, the first two guys I think of who can help manage that are Rob Pinnell and Jack Kelly. Those are the guys you want to be your calming presence on their respective ends of the field. You know, you have Pinnell, you got Ryder Garnsey, Westberg, Jules Henningberg on that offense. You've got Eppel, who's going to finish at worst second for DPOY, for Defensive Player of the Year. You've got a healthy Owen Grant now. All the tools are there for this team. You know, from a personnel point of view, there really isn't a whole lot, I think, that you can nitpick about or complain about on this team. I think they just need to be consistent, and they need to be consistently at a high level. Particularly against the Chaos in round one. Atlas end their regular season on a 3-game losing streak. They dropped 6 of their last 7. The only win in there was against the Chrome. So obviously not really trending well for the Bulls there, but I think the Miles Jones deal has worked out really well for them for the most part. I think it's tough to evaluate how you want to call it successful or not successful because the Atlas aren't winning games. You know, so do you evaluate the trade based on they got this guy and they started winning? Because if you do that, then the trade hasn't been successful. But if you look at Miles himself and his performance, he's been very productive. 7 points in 3 games. He had 3 in all 5 of his Woods games this year. He had 3 points. So, and he's scoring his points with the Atlas and getting just about the same amount, if not a little bit fewer touches than he did against the Woods. So he's a much more efficient player. He's got just 5 turnovers in those 3 games. The change of scenery is really doing him well. He's got 4 assists in there. Again, you know, it's up to you really how you want to call it a success. You know, the Atlas aren't winning. Is it a success? If you want to say no, I get it. I think it's been a success because it's obviously sparked Miles into looking like the Miles that we saw, you know, closer to the Miles we saw in 2021. He just looks more confident. He's playing better. And honestly, I feel like I have to go check what his numbers are, but if you want to look at the advanced stuff, I think the assist opportunities for him have been there in a lot of cases too, and some of them don't get converted. So I know he had 2 assist opportunities in that first game with the Atlas that didn't get converted. I know he hit a couple of pipes in that first game too. So he's really, really, I think, been good. So that trade, I think, has worked out well for the Bulls. But look, the Atlas defense has been the issue all year, particularly in transition. They're going to need a consistent game on that end of the field and some really good goaltending, I think, if they're going to try and hang with the Cannons. They went to OT against the Archers in Baltimore, so they can do it. They can play. You know, they're not a team you should take lightly. Jeff Teed has had a down year and is still one of the best players in the league. He leads the league in assists. The offense gets it done with regularity to me still. They have the 2nd best shooting percentage in the league. They're 3rd most in assists. They share the ball. They move well. You know, I think the pick of Xander Dickson, I think, was the right guy to take for this offense where, you know, it's just a guy who's going to carve you up off the ball, who doesn't need it to be dangerous, who's going to, you know, just find the windows he needs to find playing with guys like Teat and Chris Gray. It's a quality offense. I wrote a bit of a retrospective of the Atlas this year. It's on sticksandlacrosse.com. It really is more of a focus on kind of the personnel moves and some of those things and the way it's kind of, I think, affected their defense and that coupled with the rule change has kind of affected this team I think really kind of the personnel and the defense and the rule change are sort of form this amalgam of a reason for maybe why they haven't been as good. So you can go read that. We don't have to get into all that right here, but Atlas get the Cannons in round one. Like I said, they'll have to confront their biggest problem of the year. They're going to have to be efficient in the 32-second clock. Cannons are going to run the prevent. Ethan Wall is going to be out there taking faceoffs. Atlas will win every faceoff. They'll need to do something with it to have a shot in this game. The Cannons offense is too good. They share the ball too well. Alice is going to have to play their best team defense game of the year, and they need to find a way to be efficient and to score goals in the 32-second clock. They are the rare 2.5-goal underdog in this game. Does not happen often. Games are almost always 1.5 goals. I think that tells you just what Vegas thinks of their chances, but it's doable. You can't say it's not with the talent that they have on the offensive end and the opportunities they're going to have in the 32-second clock. They're going to have all those possessions off faceoff to make something happen. If they have some, you know, some jank, some scheme, whatever, to try and throw at this game, anything, this is where you bust it out. You're not saving it anymore. So you'll see maybe if they're going to try something different, this is where you see them do it. Off the faceoff, whether it's in the sub game, alignment, whatever. But this is the time to try and do it because they're going to need to create goals in the 32-second clock to win this game. Cannons 15, Whips 11 was the third game of the weekend. Whips got Burnlore back, so they're at full strength. They don't have anybody on the injury report this week. They do, however, end the year on the wrong end of two, by PLL standards, I guess, kind of lopsided games. They lost to Archers 16-11 in Seattle. And then I just mentioned they lost to Cannons 15-11 in Salt Lake. Their wins this year are against the Woods, Chrome, and the Chaos twice. So kind of middle of the road teams that they're beating. And then obviously the Chrome are bad. They haven't beaten any of the top three teams in the four games that they've had against them. 0-4 against the top three teams in the league, losing by an average of right around 3 goals in those games too. So, you know, look, to me, to be a contender, you need to be able to hang with the contenders, and the Whips haven't done that. That said, those games, you know, this is a team that played those games while ravaged by injury in the first half. They did not have a fully healthy team until the second half of the season. I kind of mentioned, you know, some of the guys that they're going to have back this week. When they played the Water Dogs, as they will play this weekend in the playoffs, the last time, they were missing Brad Smith, Matt Dunn, Michael Earhart, mostly Kyle Burnlore, and a little bit of Matt Rambo. None of that's the case this week. Whip's injury report has nobody on it. So they also just traded for Jackson Morrill. You don't do that unless you're a team that you think you can win at all. You don't trade for a player and give up a pick in the draft because you're planning for the future. You're planning to win this year. So would I be shocked to see them win at all? Absolutely not. This is the Whip Stinks we're talking about. But look, if they don't play a clean game, they don't play a smart game against the Water Dogs, then, you know, I wouldn't be stunned to see them drop the first round game either. Cannons remain obviously the story of the year, I think, from worst to the 2 seed in a year where I think, you know, they came in the worst. I think people still expected them to be near the bottom or at the bottom of the standings. You know, it's somewhere between being horrible and being like maybe a little bit better, but not good enough to contend. Nobody out there had this. It's actually funny. I was thinking about it because I was talking. The last time I think I was on with the Rise Up guys was right at camp during training camp or right after training camp. And I was joking, you know, the Cannons beat up the Water Dogs in training camp scrimmage. So obviously that means the Cannons are going to win the championship. We all laughed. Well, I'm going to have to pivot to saying I actually wasn't joking when I said that, so I can be right about it. But Marcus Holman has a legit shot at MVP. I think it's down to him and Schreiber, really, if you're asking me. You're not asking me. It could be any of them. I know. I'm going to get to the awards thing in a second. It basically, you know, it's going to be him up against his teammate Asher Nolting for attackman of the year. Garnsey's going to be in the mix too. I think they are those two guys are 1-2 in the league in points, Nolting and Holman. Nolting in particular has had a ridiculous season. I am going to try and take the time to write at length a little bit about it more, but 41 points and 40 plus point seasons in the PLL are not easy or very common. Only one or two players a year maybe actually pull it off. Lyle did it last year. I think Kieran McArdle did it last year. I think that was it. He's got 21 goals, 20 assists, shooting 35%. I mean, can you ask for more than that? What you really love, though, is the turnover number is he's got 16, just 16 turnovers in 10 games. The only players in the top 10 in scoring in the league with less are Schreiber, Garnsey, and Mac O'Keefe. O'Keefe doesn't really play the same role as the others, as somebody who's going to carry the ball a ton. So it's, you know, you wouldn't expect Mac O'Keefe to have a big turnover number anyway. Garnsey and Schreiber have one less and two less, respectively, than Asher Nolting. He's right there with those guys. If you remember, Nolting's not coming out of school was, by me and by some other people, I think it was fair to do it then, was that he could commit too many turnovers. He's a little careless with the ball maybe at times, tried to force it at times. And you would think, all right, well, pro defenses are only going to make that problem worse. Nolting has had a revelation of a sophomore season. This isn't even, it's not even close to being a problem for him. It's not even on the radar. And on top of that, again, this is his sophomore season. And this is something I kind of want to try and focus on as I try and write about him. I want to dig into this, but players will start to struggle the further they get away from college sometimes. Not just because they're getting older, but even in just their second or third year where they're still in their early 20s, they're entering their prime kind of thing, you know, but college has a regular structure of practice every day, study hall, you're with your teammates all the time. You do film together in the same room as one another. You know, you're a unit that's together all the time. The PLL does not have that. Pro lacrosse does not have that. You are on your own. You do not have the structure and organization that keep you focused and on track with lacrosse all the time. As a pro, you're on your own during the week. You get the Zoom call, you know, to do matchups, to do film, and to talk through stuff about the last week. And then you have your one practice, maybe the night before, where guys are getting off the plane and coming to practice kind of deal. There's a million reasons, obviously, why guys dip off the further they get from college when they don't have that anymore. Because not every one of those guys is going to keep up with that level of preparation and work that happened while they were in college. Nolting's trajectory being still upward is a testament to all the work that's getting done from Monday to Thursday, from Monday to Friday, that nobody sees. That's not on a social channel. That's not anywhere else, because that's what's making the difference for him right now. It's not just a natural gift thing. He's staying where he is and getting better because he's doing it, and you can tell he wants to be doing it without anybody telling him to, without the structure needed. He's built it for himself. So I think, again, his season this year has been spectacular, and I do want to try and get into that more at length. But back to kind of the games themselves, Cannons and Atlas are going to play in the playoffs. Cannons are obviously, like we said, strong favorite, 2.5-goal favorite. The Atlas do not play unsettled defense very well. The support defense hasn't been great. Cannon's offense feels built to punish those two things in particular. I think if Ethan Wall is out there running prevent and causing turnovers on it in between the lines, like he's been doing all year, that's the Atlas nightmare scenario, is that the prevent creates turnovers, not just short possessions, but turnovers off the faceoff that go the other way to an unsettled. That's the nightmare scenario if that happens a lot for Atlas. I think the Cannons are, and they should be, the heaviest favorite of the weekend, just the way the matchup shakes out. Last game of the weekend, Chaos 13, Chrome 7. Chrome season comes to an end on a 9-game losing streak. They beat the Whips week one on a buzzer beater from Cross Ferreira, and they do not win again. They only covered once all year in those 9 games. They went under in each of their last 7 games. In the PLL, like in most pro sports, scoring and kind of highlight plays are usually just at like the surface level for fans, the barometer to say this team is good and this team is not. Like as you just kind of look at box scores or look at like the numbers or whatever, you'd be like, this team scores a lot. They must be good. This team doesn't. They must be bad. The Chrome doesn't score a lot, as we know. Highlight for them this week was indeed Connor Farrell putting his shoulder into Nick Rowlett and sparking a scuffle that ended with a number of players being ejected. 3 from each team, I think. Oh, a sidebar about that. I did think it was funny, and I said this on social, but Mark Lucini and Austin Cowder ejected. They are nominated for the Sportsmanship and Teammate of the Year awards, respectively. I think that's just kind of funny that they got ejected in the last game of the season after being nominated for those awards in particular. But look, Chrome offense needs work. They don't score a lot. Anyone can see that. Nick Turn's absence, I think, was definitely notable this season, which is something of a conundrum to me. Because he was great last year. We all know that. Great player at X, quarterback, impacted the game, distributed the ball. I think Luznowskis missed having him there. He did also lead the league in turnovers. At feed-first players who handle the ball a ton, they're always going to skew towards the high end in turnovers. So it's not like it's like, you know, something that maybe you wouldn't expect him to have a lot. But Nick Turn was literally the extreme end of the stat. He led the league. So I mention this because this year there were so many games where the Chrome maybe put some offensive possessions together that were decent, that were solid, but they just couldn't string those possessions together one after another after another. They would do something good. They'd score a goal out of it. They'd get something going, but then their next possession or two would end with some just brutal turnover. And there was just a major problem for them all year, I thought. They didn't lead the league in the stat. Like, if you go look, I think they're actually like in the middle of the road. They're probably like fourth, third, fourth, something like that. I think if I went back and I looked for the team that committed turnovers at like the most brutal possible time, like the high impact turnover, I feel like Chrome would crush the rest of the league in it. Like, you know, the turnover where it's like, all right, we just scored and then we won the next faceoff and we get it to our offense. Then we throw the ball out of bounds and they pick it up quick and they get a quick restart and they go score. Like, those kind of things, I felt like every time I looked up, that was happening to Chrome. But you know what? It's water under the bridge, I guess, for them now. You got to flush it and move on. They're going to pick at the top of the draft. I think most pundits you're going to get are going to say Brendan O'Neill is the guy. I am most pundits. I believe Brendan O'Neill is the guy you have to take. I don't care if he and Wisnowskis play the same spot. I don't consider that to be a problem. I think passing on O'Neill is tantamount to passing on a guy like John Grant Jr. coming out of college. I think that's the comp. It's that lofty. I really think that's fair. Passing on O'Neal is the Cavaliers passing on LeBron James. You don't do it. The other guys that are in that are in the draft, like in LeBron's draft, are Hall of Famers. They're all-time greats. But LeBron is LeBron. LeBron James we're talking about. We don't have to get too far into the draft here. I'll have more draft kind of content and free agent content too, because that's going to be part of the Chrome plan and everybody's plan. You know, there's going to be three more teams, and we're looking forward to the draft and free agency come Tuesday morning. So that's all going to be coming soon on the site. You can keep an eye out for that. For Chaos, I think we got what you would expect them to be at the end of August and into September. They always do it when the calendar flips from August to September. Dane Smith had his season high in assists in Salt Lake City. I thought Jared Newman played his best game of the year in Salt Lake City. 8 players had goals, 11 had points. Will Bowen's making me look good for saying he should be the top poll taken in the draft. And like Jack Rowlett said on the broadcast, they have Blaze Reardon. That's kind of a key thing for them. I think that first round matchup with the Woods should be really good. They split the regular season matchup, and I really think when you get down to it, I think the Woods and Chaos is maybe the key game. Maybe the biggest game or the most kind of one I'm looking forward to most of the weekend. I think the team that comes out of that game can win the title. Everybody can. But I think the team that comes out of this game will have the best momentum towards the title of anybody left. I don't think either the Redwoods or Chaos are being taken seriously enough as contenders, to be honest. Redwoods, I think, were 3-1 after 4 weeks. They had wins over wins over Atlas Water Dogs and Redwoods, I think. No, I have that wrong. Redwoods beat Atlas. Who else? I don't know. But whatever, the Redwoods had that ugly game in Fairfield. I feel like that really sent them kind of off the rails for a few weeks. But they've won 3 straight, including 2 in OT. One of those OT wins is over the Cannons, is over the 2 seed. So they can do the damage. They can do what it takes to win. Chaos are going to frustrate teams with defense and with goalie play. And I think a key part of this game, I think, is going to be the early going. That first quarter, that first 6-8 minutes. If Blaze is hot, Rowlett, Bowen, Newman are winning against the Redwoods attack, the Chaos will have an opportunity to build a lead. I think you got to handle Garrett Eppel to do it. I think the way they do that is going to be interesting because Eppel can only guard one of Josh Byrne or Brian Minikas. But if they get the Redwoods on the ropes and the Woods start to revert to doing too much of the hero ball stuff, which they can do, if that starts happening, then the Chaos just keep the pressure up, ramp the pressure up, and they'll be able to find control, I think. If they can't do that, if the Redwoods find a ball-sharing rhythm, they get a couple of early ones past Blaze and they're feeling good, they're as good as anyone. I think this game can be decided emotionally by two very emotional teams, and I think that makes it for a really fun time. I think that kind of game is one of my favorite kinds of games to watch. So I'm looking forward to that one, I think, more than the others. Lastly, I mentioned it kind of briefly in there. PLL award finalists are out. They'll be given out Saturday night in Boston. I have submitted a ballot. I will not be sharing it until after the awards come out, I think, at all, if at all. The sports books are still taking bets, I think. I think there are still some taking bets, maybe on some of the awards. I don't know. Last time I checked, you could still make bets on some of them. Maybe not on DraftKings anymore. I can't remember. But some, you know, the point is, I think me sharing how I impacted the outcome of an award while a book is still taking bets on the award, that just kind of feels like wrong to me. Doesn't feel like something that should be happening. So that's that. I'm not going to do it until later. I have always shared my vote for my for the D1 poll, for D1 All-Americans, for the D2 and D3 stuff too. So because I think it's great for discussion. I think it's a one of the most fun parts of pro sports is that kind of stuff. The NBA literally releases, if you didn't know this, releases a PDF every year that's just, it's a list of everybody who voted and who they voted for every award. First, second, third, for every award. So you want to have a discussion with somebody about it? You can. You know, baseball Hall of Famers, I think too, a lot of them share their Hall of Fame ballots now. I think the discourse and discussion around those is really fun and really good for those leagues that have that kind of thing happen. So in my eyes, I think it's a ton of fun and good for league engagement. It's those are conversations that are at the heart of what fans love about pro sports is how do you think this guy ranks and that guy ranks and all that. Enjoy the games on Monday on Labor Day. It's going to be it for the episode today. I will be there at Gillette for the quarters for all three games. I may be, it's possible, it's a distinct possibility that I am in the building for the awards ceremony on Saturday, tomorrow night, if you listen to this on Friday. We'll kind of see how that goes. It's a really cool opportunity, so I would love to try and take advantage of it. But enjoy the long weekend, too. It's the end of the summer weekend. It's fall upon us. Football is here, but before you start getting into football, enjoy that big, long Monday of lacrosse, triple header. Enjoy your last beach weekend on Saturday and Sunday. Save Monday for the peel-out. Thank you again for sticking around with me, and we'll see you next time.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.